Good morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance to order. It's 4 minutes after 9 a.m., February 3rd, 2010. With me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and Senator Egan. Today, we're going to have a couple of presentations as we work through the week. The first one is going to be from the Department of Transportation dealing with airports, and particularly Anchorage and Fairbanks, and then we're going to follow up with the Alaska Railroad. It's kind of a overview of both the airports, major airports, and the railroad to give the committee members and the public kind of a feel for economic trends. A year ago, we were here doing the presentations, and it became very apparent that we have a possibility here of having a little leading economic indicator with the airport, both positive and negative, depending on the economic conditions of the time. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and bring the deputy commissioner up, Ms. Christine Klein, and she can go ahead and introduce herself for the record and who she represents, and then go ahead and do your presentation.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Christine Klein, the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Transportation. I would also like to bring up and introduce our Anchorage Airport Manager, John Garrett, who will probably give me a little hand on the technology here. Thanks, John. For the record,
my name is John Parrott. I'm the Airport Manager at the Anchorage International Airport.
What I thought I would do this morning is give you an update about our Alaska International Airport system. It consists of both Anchorage and Fairbanks international airports, and it has, by statute, since 1961. The reason for that is because the types of aircraft that come into Alaska International, cargo and passenger, in the remote distances in Alaska require a major international airport to divert to in times of bad weather. They share assets, resources, capital, and bonding capabilities. They're both major hubs in the national transportation system as well. Anchorage is number 3 in North America for cargo and number 5 in the world for cargo throughput. Overall, in general, for aviation industry in Alaska, the industry provides over 47,000 jobs statewide, 25,000 are direct on airports across Alaska, and 10% basically of our jobs. Aviation also provides $2 billion in direct expenditures, and indirect $3.4 billion. Basically, that's 40% higher than the national average. Our airport system advantages, and I stress always when I speak that it is a system, which is a competitive advantage in Alaska, having both Anchorage and Fairbanks as a part of the international airport system. We have very unique conditions here in our state because of our remote distances for a major airport, and we also have some very unique progressive clearances regulatory-wise that has enabled the international airport system to grow in cargo. It's much easier to have international-to-international cargo transfers, which is not common at other airports, and we have unique cargo liberalization exemptions for both the Anchorage and Fairbanks Airport, and the only other airports in the U.S. that have that are the Hawaiian Airport System. Besides other advantages that we have, our strategic location on the Pacific Asia Rim. We are considered part of the Asian airport system, but we've really never marketed ourselves as part of the aviation system of Asia, and that is something that we're starting to do now. We are also becoming a very growing base for both Chinese freighters as well as other Asian countries. We do have one revenue system where we are part of the Department of Transportation, but we are an enterprise system, which means the two airports have to operate as a business. their costs have to meet the revenue that comes in. We currently have no slots or curfews in our airport system, which makes us highly competitive compared to other U.S. airports. And we have some recently long-term commitments from our airlines, which is very exciting, particularly in this environment right now economically. With respect to our location, which I'm sure many of you have heard about over the years, we are in a very ideal location because of the payload range equation, which basically means that aircraft, cargo aircraft, can stop in the Anchorage or Fairbanks with a full heavy load, pick up fuel, and not have to carry fuel if they didn't stop. So it's very ideal for us and is also an advantage in our system. Our major competitors, however, and there are many, are Vancouver, Seattle, LAX, Oakland, San Francisco, and Sacramento. And we've been very successful over the years in keeping our rates and fees competitive, and that is something that we've focused on in the last year and a half. One of the things that helps us in terms of stability that some of our other airport competitors don't have are the range of both cargo and passenger carriers here in Alaska. We currently have over 34 cargo carriers, which is a very diverse mix. If you look at some of the names we have here and the locations, it's much more diverse than typical airports of our size. And on top of that is our whole passenger fleet as well. We have had new cargo carriers come into our market in the past year, very unusual in this economy. Great Wall Airlines has started coming to Anchorage, World Airways, and Qantas. And overall have more than 50 different airlines that come to the Anchorage airport specifically. To compare our airports with other similar airports that often have some of our fleet located there as well, I've put together a terminal rent and landing fee comparison to give you a sense of what it costs to land at other airports or utilize their terminal facilities. We hit a high point in landing fee. That's a typical benchmark that people look at, particularly for the cargo side, because cargo rarely uses the terminals, but landing fee is a majority of our revenue sources. And you can see the range of costs to land at other airports. We did hit a high of $1,700 in the last couple of years, and we've now brought that cost down to about $1,200, or a little under $1,200, to land at our airport for an average 747. So it gives you a sense of how we're doing there. And we have worked very hard over the last 2 years to lower our costs because we were seeing some extraordinary competition from some of our other airports in the U.S. that were trying to recruit some of our carrier base. We have lowered the costs, as I mentioned, and it's the first time in 8 years that we have been able to do that. In terms of our costs, cost centers, and our revenues, I've put up some pie charts here to kind of give you a sense of where our revenue comes from. Landing fees are over 37%, the majority of where our revenue does come from. And then fuel flowage fees is the second highest, and terminal rents is third. There are other sources of revenue for the system as well, but this is a very diverse mix of revenue for our airport system. On the expense side, which is the pie chart to the right, our debt service for our our debt is the highest cost in our operations. It ranges from 30 to 48% per year, depending on what's happening and when we had sold bonds in the past for some of our terminals and facilities and other infrastructure. Currently, it ranges about $50 million. In annual debt service out of our 100 annual. We currently have a debt of about $600 million, and we're trying to basically spread that out over a longer term. Cargo operations are the majority of our revenue source. It grew quickly in the last 15 years. This graph simply shows that growth rate. And between 1998 and 2008, it grew almost 3%. And then between 2006 and 2008, it grew 6% in that short period. Then in 2006, we started to see fuel decreases when we started drilling down into the monthly statistics and changes in fleet, aircraft, and landings, and started to see decreases. And then in 2007 is when we started to see cargo flatten and started to drop. I'm going to skip ahead one slide and then come back. This slide here represents the combined passenger and cargo certificated maximum gross takeoff weight, which is what the majority of our revenues come in on. And the past few years have been extremely challenging. If you take a look at this graph, 2006 is when we started to see some fuel decreases and fleet changes. 2007, as I mentioned, cargo flattened. And 2008, large aircraft loads and traffic losses occurred due to the very high fuel cost increases that we saw here, not just in Alaska, but elsewhere across the globe. In 2008, we saw a 23% decrease. That is very close to equating to our revenue in terms of a one-to-one relationship. It's not exactly, but it was very close. We were fortunate to identify some of these problems very early on, as early as May and June of 2008, and started to immediately respond. We were the first airports in the country to identify that there was a problem and jump ahead. And that is because we are one of the leaders in the world for Asia cargo traffic. So when something happens, we feel it first. And when an improvement happens, we also feel it first. And so I just wanted to point that out. The big drop there in the April, if you look at the magenta line, that was due to the Mount Redoubt volcano, that anomaly. And the reason that it doesn't come back when we look at some other charts and isn't reflected on the passenger numbers is that cargo can never recover once something like that happens. It diverts to a different airport system and doesn't come back. And so that's something I also wanted to point out. Now, the green line, which is this fiscal year from July forward, as you can see, we're seeing improvements. We're very excited. It still has not met our projections. We were projecting a plus 2% over last year's decline. We have not quite met that. November and December, for the first time in over 30 months, we saw the first positive increases in cargo, which is very exciting for us. It actually went up 11%, but we need to continue to see that trend through the year to meet our projections and budget. On the monthly enplanements, which is the passenger numbers, it's been fairly stable. And again, Alaska is a somewhat unique market in that we don't have a lot of other ways to travel other than by airports and aviation. And so we're not in quite the difficult situation that other airports in the country are. We did see some decreases, but if you notice, the magenta line, which was this last year, fiscal year 09, we actually saw an increase last summer. And then the recession effects hit us a little later. And you see the green, which is from July forward. Then we started to see the drops. So we have been fairly stable in our enplanement numbers. Fairbanks has actually picked up a little bit, which has been real interesting. On the fuel side, which is also an indicator that I like to keep track of, this is the Anchorage Airport fuel consumption from our air carriers. It's not the airport itself, but the air carriers, I would like to remind everybody. You'll see that graph started to change there in 07. This is an average of each month and year, though. So there are many peaks and drops day to day. Fuel, our peak year was over 900 million gallons. Our lowest was this past year at 600 million gallons, a drop of about 29%. It's now started to climb, and it's down right now, down 7% from last year's number, which is a very, very positive sign, because what we're seeing is more carriers coming through, and we actually hit an all-time record for the international airport system in history on November 18th at 3.2 million gallons in one day. And so that was very exciting to us. It let us know that we're on the upturn, and we have since hit a couple of record days compared to the last couple of years. Our aircraft landings have ranged from 127,000 landings a year to last year 111,000 landings. That's typically 8,000 to 12,000 landings a month. On the Fairbanks side, I did want to mention our Fairbanks partner and sister airport. They've had a little bit of different trend line on the fuel consumption. As you can see, they had a major drop back there in 06, 05, 06, and 07. That's when they took some real hits and changes in traffic. And then they've been increasing this past year, and that was due to our system information and sharing with our carriers that Fairbanks is a part of our system, and our carriers can use that system rather than go to Seattle or another airport system. And so we've been working pretty aggressively on that. And during the volcanoes and some other events, we encouraged our carriers to actually go to Fairbanks because that money stays within Alaska and the system. Since that time, we haven't had the same kind of events, so you see that little drop there. It's not due to carriers leaving Fairbanks, it's simply that we're recovering. Total freight trends, to give you a sense of how is the world doing in freight, the magenta line is the Asia-Pacific market. If you can see that magenta line that hit the very bottom there in January 2009. Our airport system actually hit bottom in November and December. It actually was earlier by several months. And we did not hit that lowest point that you see here in the world market. We were actually above that line, which was very encouraging for us. Most airports in the nation have been anywhere from 10 to 40% down in passenger and cargo. We were 23% down, so we were significantly in better shape than most, even though it was still very difficult. The past 30 months, we had 30 months of consecutive declines in cargo until October, November, and December of last year. During that time, November and December, we have seen our cargo increase by 11%. That's higher than most airports right now. Most airports are in the 5 to 7% that are our competitors. The Asia-Pacific and European cargo markets were those that were hardest hit. While we were hit hard as well, we didn't have quite the impact that most of them did because of our diverse mix. Other airports that took huge hits, 60 cities in the U.S. lost all air service for passenger. Detroit took a 17% reduction. Los Angeles took a 3% and is looking at further reductions. Louisville, which is a major, one of our anchor tenants, major hubs, took a 50% decrease, and Oakland had over 40 layoffs and a $10 million reduction. What did we do to address these things? I wanted to highlight some of the things that we have done and worked hard as a team to pull our costs in. We immediately started reducing our operating costs in June and July of 2008. We scaled back our capital program, five-year capital program, by over $400 million over a five-year term. We also have been looking at our airport debt financing and trying to spread our debt, annual debt service payments out farther rather than all up front with the heavy load that that creates. And we also, instead of increasing our rates and fees, which is a typical response in airports because you are completely reliant on your airlines, we worked hard to reduce our rates and fees so that we did not drive our cargo traffic away, which had happened in the history of this system once before. We also worked hard to look at our competition and looked at our Asian market. We brought in a third-party consultant to assess how we were doing internally at our airport system in terms of our marketing and development, and also what were other airports doing. We were able to negotiate an operating agreement that had been in holdover for years with our tenants, and we were able to reduce some of our revenues, use some of our revenues to reduce some of our rates, and so that helped us to a great degree. We did reduce our operating budget by $7 million. I know some of you had asked me about that last year because you did see a decrease in the budget figures that we presented last year. We had a freeze, a hiring freeze, for over 2 years now. And we had 9 layoffs, 6 full-time positions, and 3 college interns. So those were all things that we needed to do as a business to continue to operate safely and efficiently and continue to keep and maintain our cargo business. The results of that is that our airlines, after much discussion, finally agreed to sign our operating agreement. It had been on holdover for over 3 years. And they had simply refused to sign. And that is a very dire situation to be in this type of an economy where you're completely reliant on your air carriers. Since that time, I'm very pleased to say we have added 6 air carriers to this operating agreement that we did not have in the past. That means that they have guaranteed and are committed to pay the airport operating costs for the next 5 years. That's unheard of in this economic climate. So I think we did a good job there. We also have over 27 total, 28 as of Monday, signed up to do that. And we have reduced some of our costs, as I mentioned, on our rates and fees. And we're also trying to make sure that the different air carriers, because we have such a diverse mix, or we're moving towards a more equitable pay for what you use rather than one user group having to carry heavier burdens than others. So those are some of the things that we have done. I did want to mention a little about Fairbanks before John speaks on Anchorage. Our Fairbanks Airport has seen some real improvements over the last few years, and we don't often talk about that and highlight it, and I do want to today. They have actually increased in employments and international passenger service consistently over the last 5 years. And I unfortunately wasn't able to put the 2009 numbers in, but they also improved and increased some of their flights from Japan and Europe this past year and some of their charters. So I did want to mention that. They contribute over $4 million direct to the local economy, and they're very important to the community of Fairbanks, but also the community of Anchorage, because Anchorage Airport could not succeed without the Fairbanks Airport as a diversion airport. Other items I wanted to highlight about our Fairbanks terminal and some of the construction this past year. We're very pleased to have a new airport terminal in Fairbanks that opened on May 7th, and it was on schedule and under budget. And those types of things help us on our operating budgets right now, and it helps our airlines tremendously. It was a public-private airline partnership. I want to remind everybody that was paid for by the airlines. There is no general funds or federal funds on that particular project. It came in authorized at $96.2 million, and it came in at $92.3 million. Other things they've also accomplished this past year were our major runway construction. The air carriers, including cargo that diverted from Anchorage, had to use a taxiway all summer, and they did it successfully. There were no incursions, and the new runway in Fairbanks is also started up and running very effectively. Another accomplishment of the Fairbanks Airport is that we do have four new heavy cargo positions so that they can better support our Anchorage Airport when those diversions do occur, such as volcano eruptions of ash or weather or other things that can happen. And by the same token, the forest fires in Fairbanks this summer ended up the cargo traffic that does go to Fairbanks then came to Anchorage. So it is a very much a partnership and team effort, these two airports. I'm now going to turn it over to John to talk specifically about the Anchorage portion of our system and team, and we'll then answer any questions from there.
Thank you, Will. Many of you know we've been in the process of a 10-plus year terminal redevelopment project at Anchorage, which we were also able to conclude this past year with the opening of the A and B concourses on November 2nd. So we are hopeful that we are through with building construction for a while. It has been a long time. Many of you remember the old C concourse that was taken down in 99 to start this project. We've received very, very favorable feedback on the new concourse, and so far it's operating very well. That involved throughout the project up to 1,000 people working in jobs at the airport. All of our domestic carriers have now come back to the South Terminal. So Delta, U.S. Airways, and Continental that were in the North Terminal are now back in the South Terminal so that their passengers have all the amenities that the other carriers' passengers do. And both the B and C concourses are connected, and we have a centralized screening point to serve that. The artwork shown in the slide is from Rochelle Dowdy and was recently given an award at a ceremony in Anchorage a week or so ago for that artwork. As Christine mentioned, we have slipped a bit. We used to be number three in the world for cargo traffic. We're down to number five. In part of that is actually good news because the strength of that traffic coming out of Shanghai and Incheon, much of that continues to go through Anchorage. So while the goods are produced there, they then travel through Anchorage. So as they grow, we will continue to grow also. So it's sliding below them very slightly is not necessarily all bad. We're all linked together. In fact, if you look at Memphis and Hong Kong, those are also airports that we're linked very closely with. As Christine said, we felt the impact first and the most, and hopefully we will see the recovery soon. But we still have a very strong position in the international cargo trade. The airport in Anchorage at over 4,500 acres is a big physical part of the city. It's also a big economic part of the city. The 2007 ICER report came to the conclusion that there are about 18,000 jobs at or related to the airport. We have 400 state employees at the airport. The rest of the 10,000 people that work at the airport are employed by our tenants, the airlines, the rental car companies, the concessionaires, and then there are about 8,000 community jobs that are dependent on the airport. That totals to about $850 million total in payroll into the city of Anchorage. One in eight jobs, which I'm sure many of you have heard before. The total economic impact, some of those jobs and money that flows due to the airport, fuel purchases, construction efforts, both state and private, hotel rooms, payroll to the people downtown, the total economic impact comes out to be about $2.3 billion of money flowing through the city of Anchorage and the state of Alaska due to the Anchorage International Airport. As Christine pointed out, we have a very diverse group of carriers that serve the airport, and this slide points out not only the large number of carriers, but also which ones contribute significant amounts of money to the economy. Yeah, it would be no surprise that United Parcel Service and Federal Express are very significant contributors, but it may not be as obvious that airlines such as Korean Airlines, Cathay Pacific, China Airlines, EVA Airways, and the list goes on, are also very significant contributors to the economy of the airport, the city, and the state. And so it really is a very international flavor, and we work very closely with all of these to try to make sure their needs are met and that they continue coming to the airport. We have had some bright spots despite the economic downturn. As Christine said, we have new international carriers. That is a bit of a difficult game to keep track of. As you all know, air carriers merge. They leave the market. They come into the market. They're created. They're dissolved. The good news is, as long as the packages and the cargo keeps coming through Anchorage, we'll do our best to keep track of the name on the airplane that's carrying it. In the past, the airport has never needed or seen the need. The system has not seen the need for an incentive program to try to get carriers to come to our airports. In the past year or so, we were in discussions with China Airlines. They were concerned about the economy of their flight that came through Anchorage between Taipei and New York. And we worked with them and came up with an incentive program that was acceptable to the other carriers. And it was acceptable primarily because while we provided a reduced fee structure to China Airlines, they added more flights. So the net result is more revenue, more service between the state of Alaska and Asia, which was one of the things we felt was very important to preserve and try to increase. We also have the Japan Airlines charters that come through both Anchorage and Fairbanks, depending on the time of the year. And it's not all about airplanes, though. It's also a significant part about the passengers that get on the airplane. So it's not all cargo. It's a lot cargo, but not all cargo. And our concession folks have come up with some fairly innovative ways that have been recognized nationwide as far as setting up contract agreements with the concessionaires. We have now tied the percentage that the airport system gets paid to the number of passengers. So as the number of passengers increases, as the concessionaires sell more goods, the airport system gets a higher percentage of the money that's being spent. So everybody benefits by increases in passenger traffic. And that's now being looked at by several airports around the country. We continue to look for more people that we can bring in to the airport. I would be remiss if I didn't mention, although it's absolutely no surprise to anyone that's been in the terminal, one of our concession bright spots was that we now have McDonald's, and that has made many people apparently very happy based on the lines in front of McDonald's that I see each day. But we also are out marketing, trying to get new traffic to come to the airport. We are in conversations with European operators to try to get year-round service back between Alaska and Europe. We're talking to at least three domestic passenger airlines, one of whom we still have a hope of getting in this summer. We've taken all of our marketing material, we've reviewed it, updated it, tried to make it more germane and to the point for today's economy. We've also translated a great deal of it into Mandarin Chinese, which is a language that, as you know, many of our carriers are familiar with in their corporate headquarters, trying to make it easier for them to understand what we offer. It is more than just a place to stop and change a crew and get gas. And as Christine pointed out, that cargo transfer authority is very important. It is a value added in Alaska, and it's something we are working very, very hard to market to those carriers so that they understand what we offer them. We also try to work with all the other groups that are trying to market Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Alaska. The Convention and Visitors Bureaus, the Economic Development Corporations, ATIA, any agency, state or private, that's over in Asia in particular trying to market the state, we want to be involved in, because whether they're marketing business or they're marketing passenger traffic, the airport is an integral part of that. The airports are an integral part of that. And we want to make sure that it's a coordinated effort so that they get one message, and that is, we want your business in Alaska. We have been represented at a couple trade conferences and cargo conferences recently by our cargo consultant, and we have both state personnel and our passenger consultant getting ready to attend a conference on passenger traffic to keep those ties open and try to encourage people to come up. It has been a mixed bag of good news and bad news. Obviously, 2009, as everyone knows, we were down. In both landings, cargo and passengers, enplanements, biggest indicator, fuel uplift. In 2010, well, we're not up from 08. We're starting to get above 09, and we take that as a good sign. The decreases we have from previous years are lessening, and we're cautiously optimistic. There are a lot of dynamics involved in the statistics that we look at, as you're well aware. There was the pre-Christmas rush. There was a lot of backlog of cargo in Asia. We saw all that come through in November. That led to some of those big fuel uplift days. December held on and looked pretty good. January, from looking out the window, was another solid month. So we haven't seen the drop-off that we were fearful of. It appears that we might be stabilizing and looking to find a way back up. Future plans, obviously we need to stay competitive. There are airports, other than Prince George, there are airports that are out there looking for our business. It's significant business, it's a lot of money, and they would love to find a way to take it from us. We historically are blessed with our geographic location. We intend to continue capitalizing on that, but at the same time, it's not just about location. We believe it's important to have relations with the airlines and to be able to show them the value added that Alaska has to offer. So that's the economics of it. We want to grow and diversify our revenue sources. As Christine pointed out, some airports get most of their revenue from their parking. Some get most from their concessions. We get most of ours from landing fee and fuel flow. We'd like to grow the concessions part of that. We might want to look at the parking part of that. We want to diversify that revenue so no one thing can cause us a problem. We'll continue with the capital program. We have a program over the next two summers where we will be reconstructing runway 7 right, which is our primary instrument cargo landing runway. That project is significant enough that despite our best efforts at pushing, we've been convinced that it will take 2 years to complete. So we will do the eastern half of the runway this coming summer and the western half of the runway the following summer. In addition to that, we will extend the runway 1,500 feet to the west, which is a project that has been a very successful public process to bring the Nordic Ski Association and others that might have been opposed to that are actually in favor of the project and believe everyone will benefit from it. So it's been a very positive outcome. That will enable, once again looking at competitive edges, that will enable cargo aircraft to turn off the runway sooner, taxi more directly to their parking spaces, not spend as much time on the ground, not spend as much time burning fuel, not spend as much time making noise, not spend as much time making emissions. So all good things, and that's the type of capital project we're going to continue looking at, something that is needed and effective and improves the efficiency of the airport. We will continue pushing hard with our new marketing team. We work with the folks in Fairbanks on a daily basis, sometimes multiple times a day, to make sure that we and our community agencies all have a united effort and are all giving the same speech and the same encouragement to folks to come to our airports. The other big thing looming on the horizon, Kulis Air National Guard Base, as part of the BRAC process, the folks in the airplanes are moving to Elmendorf. We will be picking up the property and many of the buildings on the property, and we are currently engaged in a process with the community, with the West Anchorage District Plan, with other state agencies to determine what is the highest and best use of that property to meet aviation needs, to meet potential non-aeronautical needs on some portions of that property, and also take into account the needs and desires of the surrounding neighborhood, who are very fearful that there might be a significant change there. So a lot of issues with the community, but we're a big chunk of the community, and we understand that, and we believe it's important to work together with them to come up with the best solutions.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The presentation was quite enlightening on many fronts, but one area that I'm interested in is how this Anchorage International Airport services Alaskans. And I did not hear anything in your report to the Finance Committee, and I think the people that are watching today would be greatly interested in what is happening at the International Airport on some of the charts that you have here, specifically the air cargo operations. Are the air cargo numbers that you have here for the Anchorage Airport and the Fairbanks Airport strictly international numbers, or are they encompassing numbers that include cargo to Alaska destinations? And the emplanements on the following page, are those all international emplanements, or are they to Alaskan destinations such as Barrow, Kotzebue, Nome, Dillingham, Sitka, all areas? You know, I think that would be something that I would be interested in. You talk about the McDonald's. I'm pretty sure those lines there aren't lines that are of people that are from coming in here from the lower 48, but are Alaskans. So it would be interesting for me to see what the Anchorage International Airport numbers are regarding the people from Alaska and how they are impacted. I've had several comments from Barrow to down southeast to different parts of Alaska saying that the international airport is a very good airport in its redesign for people that are flying south and that are people that are flying on other than combi flights, but of a large portion of Alaskans use the combi aircraft, and the services that they receive in their communities, such as Kotzebue, Barrow, and Nome, Bethel, and other places, it's much easier for them to access that combi flight, but it's very, very cumbersome in the main place that has the wherewithal to make it more efficient for them to access those that aircraft. I don't know if any of you have traveled out on the combis to villages, to communities, hubs all over Alaska. But when it was one of the concourse of a CO, it was through a maze that you had to go through. And then once you get down there, you have to run this gauntlet that the wind is blowing through and snowing blowing through and is very unuser-friendly. And I would wonder if you might comment on those, and are we going to see improvements for Alaskans?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, those are certainly our concerns too. We recognize that we don't just serve the international community, we do serve the people of Alaska. Let me address a couple of those points. The concessions issue is often brought up by the folks flying on the regional airlines. Part of our terminal project also included the A concourse, where we have accommodated the new Era Alaska company. We've given them an expanded boarding area. We've rehabilitated that portion of the terminal, and we've consolidated through partnership with the air carriers the regional carriers in one parking area on the ramp. That gives them the advantage of having like aircraft parked together. All of their passengers who do not have to be screened are in one part of the terminal and have easy access to their aircraft. We have a project currently in the development stage to provide additional food service, hot food service, to those folks that are not going through screening and getting back into the main concourse, because we recognize that while there is food service available, it's not to the same standard, and we're working both in the main portion of the terminal at the screening checkpoint to have a restaurant that will provide food, and then an additional food service down at the A concourse. The numbers that we show, unfortunately, when we speak fuel flow, those numbers, the fuel pumped by the regional carriers, or for that matter, even Alaska Airlines, tends to be dwarfed by the fuel pumped into the 747s. The emplanements, however, do include the regional and the domestic passenger carriers. So those numbers do reflect travel of Alaskans both in and out of and within the state of Alaska. And finally, specifically to the combis, they no longer board through C0. In fact, Christine and I came down on a combi. We boarded a gate C4, which is one of the Alaska Airlines gates, which now boards not like all the other aircraft, because loading from the rear, you can't use a jet bridge, but you're sitting in the same gate seating area as if you were flying to Seattle. You simply go down the stairs and out on the ramp, and then up the air stairs into the rear of the aircraft. And that's basically dictated not by the airport, but by the fact that the cargo has to go in front, and we don't have Alaska nor anyone else has jet bridges that will reach the rear door. But it is no longer the long outside walk that it was while we were under construction. We recognize that was not ideal, but we only had so many places to put the airplanes until we got a ramp back, which we did this winter. And hopefully those improvements will help out. And if there are more improvements that will better serve the local traffic, we'd be happy to take a look at them.
So from Mr. President, so from your viewpoint, the current system is as user-friendly as it can be for people that fly the combi?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, I always believe there's room for improvement. I believe we've made significant progress, but if there are, the combi is a unique fixture here in Alaska. It will always have some issues, but if there are things we can do to make it better, we'd be happy to take a look at it.
Well, I'm not in the airport management system, and I think the international airport system people have the personnel to look at that, and I would appreciate it if they could look at it and if there's any way to make that system a little bit more user-friendly, it would be appreciated.
Through the chair, certainly, sir.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. Just a couple of questions. How much of the fuel that's consumed at the two main airports, anyhow, comes from Alaska, and or if not all of it, where does it come from? Do you track the pricing of that fuel, Alaskan produced, versus prices that would be in LAX and Seattle and Vancouver, the places that would be probably our main competition on the West Coast, anyhow?
Through the chair. Senator Thomas, currently Alaska only produces 49% of the fuel that is consumed at the international airport system. That has been a challenge for us, partly because of the long-term decline that we've seen over the last few years and some of our refinery capabilities. With respect to the price, that's very difficult for us to track because airlines buy fuel themselves. They actually are the ones who purchase it, bid, and long-term contracts, so that can vary greatly. However, we do know, and it has been brought to our attention by our carriers, that Alaska's price of fuel is significantly higher than our competitors.
Follow-up, Senator Thomas?
Just a little bit separate subject. I'm having a little trouble following the some of the landings, and I was just curious. First question, I guess, is I'm surprised at Memphis. Is that because FedEx or somebody, that's their terminal or something like that, or main aggregation point or whatever?
Yes, sir. Virtually everything that FedEx flies goes through Memphis.
Okay. And then some of the landings, I'm looking at one of your last slides, a summary of 09 and 10 so far. Those are cumulative percentages, so the tracking is down, right? Even though it's the curve may have flattened out a little bit, it's still a downward trend at this point in time.
Through the chair, yes, sir. For the fiscal year, which began in July, it was a decrease. In the past few months, we've seen an uptick. So that hasn't changed the year's percentage yet. For the year, it's still down, but we now see an upward trend that if it continues, will bring fiscal year 10 perhaps above fiscal year 9.
And just one last question. If you could remind us a little bit, last year's budget, I believe Anchorage International was a couple hundred million plus, I think, but you mentioned only one project. What others are we looking forward to at this point in time, or am I mistaken the numbers? It seemed like it was a rather large number, and you mentioned extension of one runway. I was hoping that there would be more than that in that amount of money.
Through the chair, sir, the Seven Right resurfacing and extension project will be
close to $100 million over the next two summers. That is the significant capital project that we have on the books for the next 2 years.
Okay. Thank you.
Deputy Commissioner, under the impression when the tide goes out, you're going to head down the channel and won't be returning to do this presentation again. And I'd like you to take the opportunity to look into your crystal ball and tell us what's coming over the next 6 to 12 months. And don't worry, we won't hold you to it too close because we know it's just a guess.
Senator Stedman and the rest of the committee here, I think most of you know I'm very passionate about airports, and I have had an opportunity, and I'm leaving my airports, as I call them, in great shape. In terms of a crystal ball, what do I see in the next 6 to 12 months? I think we'll have very, very slow recovery. The budget is balanced through this year, through June 31st, if everything carries on and there's no major changes or volcanoes or forest fires in Fairbanks, we should all be in good shape. The cargo recovery, I think our controller and our controller's on the line as well. We had projected a very modest 2% increase for this year, and probably the next couple of years if we're fortunate. And right now we haven't quite met that, but I think by year end we probably will see an increase. But we're going to continue to see, if you look at this combined passenger and cargo graph, you're going to see that green line go up very slowly, and that's a good thing. Even flat is positive right now in our world. The airline business has entirely changed. The business models have changed, and our team here is responding to that probably faster than most teams because we were able to see it earlier. But I don't think you're going to see a return to our previous levels for several years. It's going to take some prudent business management, but it's not insurmountable, and I think we're on the road to recovery, and I'm very proud of my team and what we have accomplished.
Okay, thank you. We'll go to Senator Ellis, and then Senator Huggins, and then Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Parrott, thank you for being here, and I want to, like Senator Hoffman, I want to mention some things that that I've heard that they're small things, but important things to folks, things that infuriate them about the airport. And overall, you know, I think you're doing a good job there compared to your predecessor in particular. One thing I heard in the C-Concourse, I was washing my hands in the restroom and heard cursing coming from another part of the bathroom. A fellow had gone to put his coat on what he expected to be a hook on the back of the bathroom door in the stall, and it fell on what wasn't the cleanest floor there in the bathroom. And he came out to wash his hands and was cursing and raving about the lack of hooks in the bathroom. And I didn't go to check on the C-Concourse or the new concourse to see if someone paid a lot of money for new bathrooms without coat hooks in Alaska. Now, you know, the guy was talking about in Los Angeles, on the back of the stalls and the restrooms, there's a place to put a coat where not many people are wearing coats, but in Alaska, you would think your designer of your facilities would think of coat hooks. He went on to talk about other airports in the restrooms, design their restrooms so that computer bags and other bags can be put someplace so they don't have to go on what is sometimes a filthy bathroom floor. But no one thought of that with the redesign of the airport concourse. So if you could think about that, maybe the place for the computer bags and the other personal bags in the restroom isn't possible at this point, but coat hooks seems like a reasonable request. The other thing, I'm sure you've walked through the airport and noticed people jockeying for position for an electrical outlet. In this day and age, everybody has to plug in. And you barely seem to have enough electrical outlets for the floor buffers and the cleaning crews' vacuum cleaners. I don't know if there's a way to rectify that or help with that situation, but people are not having fistfights, but arguing over electrical outlets in your hallways. The third line is the continuing frustration. It's better than it used to be years ago, the cab line out front. There are near fistfights in your lack of a cab line. There's a sign there, but where the terminal spits out people there coming up the escalator to get to the cabs, they spill out there and they're in front of the cabs, but the cab line is a number of feet to the east. And so there's all kinds of problems there, and the cab drivers don't care about the line. They just come and pick up the people that have spilled out of the terminal while there's a line of people down at the other end becoming furious. I'm sure you've observed all this, and maybe there's something you can do about it.
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, I will go back and find out what stall doesn't have a hook. Most of them do. And I can confirm that from watching people with their carry-on bags, many of them hold a lot more weight than our designer probably thought they would. But that is a convenience that is absolutely expected at a terminal like ours. And I know we have some benches and some other places to set things, but a lot of people are worried about theft and other issues, which, quite frankly, we have very little of. But I will go back and ensure that we have places for people to hang their coats and their bags. The power outlets, the philosophy I've told our folks is figure out how many you need, double it, and that might get us through 3 years, and it's proven to be a little short-sighted that's not enough. Part of that is driven by our leaseholders, the airlines who lease those gate spaces. We do make that power available for free. And I will look into seeing if we can add some more outlets or possibly direct people to where the lesser used outlets are so that they'll at least know where they are. I know there are some companies that sell airport chairs where there are outlets in the chairs. Some of those also have a slot for the quarters and the dollars to go into. We prefer trying to keep it manageable and provide that for free because it is just an expected part of being in an airport. The your final point, the cab line is a frustration. We have had the cab line at various places and tried to move it and modify it and there doesn't seem to be a place that works. And when you get the cabs too close to the shuttles, well then the cabs are okay, but you have the cab drivers and the shuttle drivers having fights instead of the passengers jockeying. And it is an ongoing process. We will continue to work it. Now that we have all the domestics back over in the South Terminal, the dynamics have changed a bit because we no longer need cabs at the North Terminal nearly as much. So we will be taking another look at that in particular as we head into summer to try to make that a smooth and efficient operation. And I hope you see improvement in it in the future.
Thank you.
Just a follow-up real quick, Senator Hoffman.
One other one since... I traveled overseas, and it's a question that Senator Menard asked me to ask if I had the opportunity, and I know the pros and cons, but the question was that she brought up was when traveling to Europe and to Asia, the carts for baggages over there are provided free, and it seems as though that's a big convenience, and I know that it's a moneymaker for the concessionaires, and if we had them free, we'd have to figure out how to get them back in place and everything else. But what is the status of why we have that, and what other international airports have pay for baggage carts, and why are we different than many European and Asian countries?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman. Part of that I've noticed when I have traveled overseas, and even in our airport, if you are an international traveler and you're coming through the customs area, the baggage carts are provided for free because we recognize, because of the currency exchange and other things, you're going to need that cart before you perhaps have the right kind of money to pay for it. So in the international section, coming off an international flight, they are free. I do know that in many European airports and in the many Asian airports, there is advertising sold on the carts to offset the cost of providing them for free. We have looked at that. We have not been able to find anyone that's willing to pay that much and to keep the advertising looking good, which is a challenge. Most of the airports that I have been in the United States do charge for carts in the domestic flights. And that's an area we are once again looking to try to optimize our non-airline revenue, and we will continue to look at that and see if there's a better way to do it. We do try to work very diligently to keep our prices down on the carts and make sure that we're not gouging folks, because we recognize that Alaskans, in particular, tend to travel with a little more baggage perhaps than folks who are just traveling for the weekend. So we try to make it reasonable, and if there's a way to make it more reasonable or even eventually get to free, we'll certainly continue looking at that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Huggins, you had a question? Could you slide the mic?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple of feedbacks. In my experience, people coming through to Alaska, the visitors, the business of the game, the wild game displays are much appreciated, and big conversation piece amongst kids, and I think that's appreciated. In my estimation, probably one of the greatest improvements we made at the airport, which the legislature partnered with, was the rental car. Overall, I can tell you from some of my friends that fly in and out that are military, the facilities for the military lounge are much appreciated, so I pass that on to you. In my estimation, in going and coming places, our customs within the Anchorage Airport is about as good as it gets. And it's not as many people, but it's about as good as it gets. I would encourage you to look at the north terminal parking. It appears to be a constraint that I'm not sure what the plan is about expanding, but one that bears some attention. Let me go to fuel quickly, if I might, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned 49% of the fuel came from Alaska, as I recall.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is correct. 49% of the fuel that's consumed.
Right. Do you know which refineries it came from?
Well, it's Tesoro, Flint Hills, and PetroStar. The percentages I don't have off the top of my head right now, but I do know those.
My question goes to the cost of fuel coming from our domestic refineries within the state versus those that we've imported from. I assume the imports are from Lower 48.
The imports are actually from, it really depends where the best price is. It can be off the high seas, it can be from the Middle East, or it can be from the U.S. It's quite a complex issue. However, we have been working with our airlines, the refineries, and our fueling consortium to try and look at how we might help facilitate some improvements there. I can't tell you the percentage, but the spot price that we heard that was communicated to us, but again, this was not a bid price, it was about 20 cents difference.
And which is more favorable?
It's more favorable at other airports in the U.S. currently.
Right, and if I might, if some of my constituents mentioned to me that the airport is subsidizing aviation fuel. I just asked that public question whether that is in fact happening.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins, that is not correct. I'm not sure where the question or the comment could have come from
just
in the context.
My constituents, there's always a battle going on about the debate of cost of fuel and paying more and what have you.
Yeah, airlines typically bid and they nominate. It's a process where they nominate fuel and they bid long-term contracts for the volumes they think that they are going to have. If that changes suddenly, they then have to go out and buy spot fuel, which is at a higher cost, just like you would say at a gas station or something. And so some of the turmoil that has occurred recently is that the sudden increase here in our Alaska system created a little bit of a rush on fuel, and there wasn't local fuel available, and it takes time to bring fuel into Alaska. And so some of those issues came to the surface very quickly because, one, they couldn't get the fuel they needed, the supply, and, two, the price was much different than they're used to getting anywhere else.
Follow-ups?
Yeah, follow-up, which brings me to self-sufficiency. And I'm concerned whether it be climatic, but particularly international emergency sorts of things, where we're talking about the robustness of our airports, and if we don't have adequate fuel based on some interruption of the source. But I would just ask you to give us a 60-second burst whether you have that same concern or not.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. Yes, we do have a concern with refined Jet A fuel supply in Alaska. We are currently, our commissioner, the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Conservation and the commissioner of DNR and others are looking at this issue right now to figure out how can we help facilitate something that we really don't control. It's a private business, but those discussions are going on right now and it is a concern.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
If we could get some follow-up information from the airport on just if you could look back a year or 2 years and give us a closer idea on what fuel was produced or purchased at the airport from the state, which refineries they came from, and then the offshore, kind of where that fuel came from. It'll be handy in future discussions when we have presentations from the refineries and other economic issues, so you can just help us with that. And they don't have to be to the gallon, but just try to give us an idea of where those supplies are coming from. Senator Thomas is going to stand in for Senator Egan on a question, because Senator Egan is called out of the meeting.
Yes, he had a question, and I had one short one as well. Senator Egan's question was that 8% of the fiscal year 09 revenue comes from investment income, and that seemed to be high for cargo slash passenger operations, and was curious if that was, you know, somewhat typical or not of airport operations outside of the state.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, the investment income that we have had has actually decreased in the past year, like many investments. However, how much it decreased, I do not have a readily available, and I would have to defer to our controller and our chief financial officer.
Okay, I'm sure you would appreciate that response. And the other question I had, if I may, was as we look at the cost of fuel, obviously it's a bigger question because the fuel that comes from the refineries is a royalty oil fuel, and there's always been a concern expressed to at least me by Flint Hills that the premium that they're paying for royalty oil is what impacts that cost and causes it to be a higher amount, obviously. And then, of course, because of the way it's calculated, as if it went outside and came back, there's a premium paid versus jet fuel that would be produced, say, in Cherry Point or Long Beach. So that would be helpful from your perspective, how you see that impacting the airport operations, and if in fact that makes a difference of your ability to purchase fuel, or if in fact the percentage that you're purchasing is everything that they're able to produce. And like I said, you're thinking about it now, but maybe in response to the other questions from Senator Stedman, you might include your concept there, your feelings on that, because that will impact, I'm sure, other considerations that we have for our energy and needs within the state and how we approach those.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, I can't speak to the contractual agreements that the state has to its refineries. That is not something that I'm familiar with. I did come from oil and gas, but it's not something I worked on. You would best put that question to someone else. With respect to the pricing, that is also a concern. Alaska must be just as competitive as the rest of the United States when it comes to Jet A fuel if it is to remain a very competitive cargo airport. And that has been a concern voiced by the major Asian and international carriers. And that is something that we're trying to understand as well, because a lot of that pricing is not something we control or know a lot about, because those are contractual business obligations between private businesses, and we don't have that information.
Okay. Thank you.
Your follow-up, and then we're going to go on to the next presentation.
Yeah, just one follow-up. The question is strategic vision on airports. Recently, I was down in Denver, and they had a strategic vision, and they moved their airport. I'm not saying we need to move our airport, but sometimes airports do move, or at least the cargo piece of it moves, or some component of it. And my question for you in your strategic plan, as you look to the future, some of my neighbors over in Mat-Su said we have the perfect location. We have rail, we have a port, we have a system that you don't have to drive through town. I mean, all those sorts of things, which equals why airports move. And I would ask you where we fit in your strategic plan.
Through the chair, Senator Huggins. In the last 40 years, there have only been two major airports constructed in the United States. One of those was the new Denver airport. This is a very costly enterprise to build airports with the capacity that we have, the infrastructure, utilities, runways, roads, terminals. Considering we have just improved our capacity in our system, Fairbanks and Anchorage, I think it would be very difficult for the state of Alaska to look at building a new airport with the type of investment that's been put into this one and the debt service and the debt we have right now. I'm not sure our airlines would support it, and because our airlines are the ones who pay for these costs, I think it would be something we'd have to be very cautious about discussing. I do recognize there are issues with a city that has grown up around the airport and has tremendous pressure, both politically, community-wise, neighbors, you name it, on Anchorage Airport in particular. But those are things that can be worked, that's not to say that a private enterprise could come in and build a cargo airport if they saw profitability in it, but you don't often see that happening, and it hasn't happened recently other than the new Denver and another airport. The costs are just too high.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for your presentation today. I think,
Mr. Chairman, well,
you have a
can
question?
Can I just ask a question, please?
Go ahead.
I know you're trying to get on to the next presentation, but there are certainly a number of issues that have been brought up, and I appreciate your coming to the presentation today because you're very, very professional, and certainly after the scrapping that's gone on between the last administration and the legislature with the cost overruns of what's gone on, I think it's important that we did have a change. But my concern has to do with what Senator Hoffman talked about. The people that elect us are the voters that are out there. And I hear a lot of this, good news about the revenues that are coming in from international airport, but with all due respect, they don't elect us. The people that elect us, there's a little old lady that's trying to get out through Concourse C0 or now Concourse A, trying to get out to the combination airport, and many of the people have gone to Anchorage for medical reasons, and many of these people are in wheelchairs, and so we are sensitive to that. But the other thing I want to point out is that General Aviation and the 135 operators are out there. One of the concerning comments you made was that you're trying to level the playing field between those people that are paying for landing fees and those that aren't. Are you envisioning that to be with the 135 operators paying the same thing as the 121 operators? And the concern that I have is the 135 operators have got a much lower max gross takeoff weight than the 135 operators that are out there, and they have less wear and tear on the airports, as well as they don't have to go through TSA. So their operations, their expenses to the airport, I think are quite a bit less. I hope that's not what you're trying to do.
I think before you answer that question, and I know we got to get onto the railroad, but you'll have to help the chair here with all those fancy acronyms and definitions.
And actually, Mr. Chairman, we can talk in private because I know you have a major presentation coming on. We can talk about, but those are the concerns that I have, that I hear about over and over again.
Okay. Maybe just briefly define what the 135 is and the other numeric for another type of carrier real quick, and then we'll go on to the next presentation.
The 135 operators, essentially the smaller operators that, initially started with 180s and carry people within a smaller locale. The 121 operators are both the passenger and cargo carrying capabilities that are there, exemplified by Alaska Airlines.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, and you can get with Senator Olson on helping with the answer of his questions, and then maybe get back to the committee on the fuel questions and information that you could help us with as far as fuel volumes and
Did you want me to answer that question?
Briefly, so
yes.
We've got to get to the railroad.
Through
the general's back there getting all excited here.
Through the chair, Senator Olson. Actually, I can say we are very focused on rural Alaska. I just did not get the sense that that was the interest today, because we could speak at great lengths about all these different issues. We have put a lot of attention on our rural and regional carriers in the last couple of years, and it is something that I am particularly passionate about, and my staff have come along with me. We spent an extra month and a half on the airport operating agreement so that we could include the smaller regional carriers in the benefits of lower rates and fees. And because of their lighter weight aircraft, that was very difficult to do. But we have done it. The majors came along with that to ensure that the regional air carriers that are our bread and butter in Alaska could get the benefits of being a signatory carrier. So we are addressing those issues. I think we have quite a bit of work yet to do, though, on the terminal infrastructure to make things easier. And I did hear Senator Hoffman and yourself speak to that, and I think my staff do fully understand those concerns and are trying to figure out how to do it cost effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And thank you for your presentation today.
Thank you.
And we're going to move on now to the next and final item. We're going to have Mr. Gamble come forward with Alaska Railroad. He's got a presentation. What we're going to try to do here, we've got about 40 minutes, so we'll try to keep the presentation to about 20 minutes to 25 minutes. Target on the economic health, if you could, of the railroad and the impact that's been going on, particularly with fuel issues and so on and so forth, so we have time for some questions. And apologize for getting to you guys a little late.
For the record, Mr. Chairman, my name is Pat Gamble, President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and I have with me Mr. Bill O'Leary, who's the CFO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation. To take away the horror at a 40-slide briefing that's in front of you, let me start off by saying that a lot of the material in this briefing is boilerplate, and it's because I've spoken to every one of you in the past on the railroad, it's principally for new staff members and maybe folks who are not that familiar with the railroad. We're not going to go through all that. We're going to do a Huntley-Brinkley and skip to certain slides in here that kind of get to the point so that we can get to the question and answer sessions as quick as possible. And of course, we'll stop and respond along the way if there's something we want to back up to. We've also included a handout, a sheet here, a separate handout. There was a question that came to us about what our bonding indebtedness is and what kind of debt it was, whether it was recourse to the railroad or not. And that sheet summarizes for you what the answer to that question. So, and I'll just present that for the record as well in addition to the briefing, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I'll go straight to slide three. The only things that have gone up on slide three are the net assets, are the total assets of the railroad. That's a good thing. And then the average age of the employees. Everything else on that chart just about has gone down, from the number of rail cars and locomotives to the number of people. And the net income and projections. That kind of sets the stage for what I'm going to talk about. It's been a tough year. It started in 2007. It got tougher in 2008, tougher yet in 2009. And while the bottom line in 2009 is we're down about 19% from our projected net earnings when we built the budget for 2009, which actually isn't bad compared to big companies all over the country. And that includes an environmental or legal accrual, which is probably worth $500,000, which came right off the bottom line. So you could add that back on. We actually earned that money. We are, in fact, looking at 2010 and thinking that 2010 is probably going to be our toughest year yet. 2008 and 9, particularly 9, were the years we've been preparing for that tough year. And that's what you're going to hear today in our briefing and see as you go through this in detail. Having said that, I always make one comment on slide four, particularly for the staffers. We are different from other state agencies. We're unique in the sense that we're not part of the Executive Budget Act. We have our own retirement system. Our employees are not in the state employee system, and we pay for those things out of our own earnings. We also pay for our federal match out of our own earnings. So we're much like a private business in the sense that we need to make a profit, not just run it a sustainable basis like the law says, but make a profit. That is our capital program in essence, and it allows us the flexibility, the model that we're under, to be able to respond in a competitive market in the areas of business that we're in. Other than that, on slide four, you can see the other things that attach us to the state in many different ways. So we're certainly not entirely independent of the state. I'd like to skip to slide six, please. Always like to make a comment about safety. If that's an hour-by-hour thing in the railroad business, you're only as good as the last hour that you were safe. And so we always talk about our safety program up front. We had what I call a decent safety year. We had the all-time record low number of injuries on the employees. That's a good thing, and the kinds of injuries were very minor. We had a reduction in the lost days over 2008, a nice reduction in medical claim dollars, workman's comp, that was created in the year 2009. We started an extensive hearing conservation program for our older employees that have been on the railroad for a long time to make sure they're getting their fair and just entitlements in that area. And we've done a number of other things. That's part of the money, both on the operating side and the capital side, that we put back into the company. Slide seven. A few years ago, we didn't even talk about security other than to say protecting railroad resources and chasing people off the right-of-way that shouldn't have been there. That's not the case anymore. Security is a big deal. And the idea that a train can be a target is very much alive and well. We've seen that happen in the UK and Spain and India. And so now we are tapping into federal dollars that are available for people like us on the railroad to enhance our ability to provide actual security on the railroad. And you can see some numbers in here and some of the things that we've been able to do. We've got a camera system all over the railroad now that's quite modern and pretty effective. And we get inspected regularly, and that's that bottom bullet that talks about all the different agencies that come in now and give us inspections or that want to exercise with us to exercise potential events and how we would respond with our partners, both military and civilian, in the community. I'd like to go to slide 13. There's some gee whiz information about the railroad that leads us up to slide 13. Slide 13 is where we start talking a little bit about what 2009 looked like as we went into it. We did not know what fuel costs were going to be in 2009. We came off of a volatile year in 2008. And so in 2009, fuel has gone down and it's gone back up again. It seems to have settled out. We've actually done some hedging in fuel, something we haven't done in several years. And then, of course, we are still continuing to see a total volume drop on the part of our principal customer, fuel customer Flint Hills Resources in North Pole. And that has a lot to do with why we think 2010 is going to be a tough year, because we're going to see them drop further. At least that's what they're forecasting. And of course, we just live off their forecast for revenue purposes in that major customer area. When we started 2009, as I said, we were budgeted for 16.8. We took a hit in passengers. We took a hit with Flint Hills that year. The price of fuel, which is a big component in what we do, and so that's where the 19% came off of, that 16.8. You're going to see the unaudited numbers, and by the way, this is unaudited information, but it's probably up in the 90-plus percentile accuracy at this particular point. We get audited late in the spring, and we'll have audited numbers by about the 1st of April, but these are very, very close. The last dash on slide 13 talks about, 50 plus percent of our expenses in employees, and so we had to turn in 2008 and 2009 to the kinds of things that deal with employment and employees in order to help offset expense, in order to keep track with the drop in revenue, and I'll talk more detail about that. on the next slide, slide 14. We started a hiring freeze in 2007 as we began to see the indicators start to pop up, warnings and indications that all was not well when we started seeing the revenue projections drop in the year of execution, which is always tough to deal with. 2008, we were actually dead on our budget up to June. We were within $120,000 of over $100 million budget in June, halfway through the year, when the bottom dropped out, basically due to Flint Hills, and then we were suffering still the effects of the after effects of some volatile fuel pricing. And we had to, for the first time, actually go into reducing the number of employees on the Alaska Railroad to be able to keep up and reduce expenses. That continued in 2009. When we built the budget in 2009, once again, we saw the revenues going down, and we went back to the employee force again. The numbers that are on slide 14 then sort of summarize what's been done, the freeze in 2007 in hiring, and then the reductions in 2008 and 9 totaled nearly 200 employees, and you see the percentages there. The seasonals are the ones that come in the high season, and we employ them during the summertime, and then they're gone. So those folks, for example, would not get a pink slip. They just simply wouldn't be recalled again. And that's where the 24% seasonal comes in. Actual pink slips, you can see that. We took a lot out of management, both at the top end and middle management. There's an executive vice president position here that's not listed, that's gone. There are no more AVPs in the Alaska Railroad Corporation. We either got rid of the position or we downgraded them to what we call directors. And we're in our second year of a management pay freeze. We froze pay last year. We're freezing pay again in 2010. So there'll be no pay raises for managers. That does not affect labor. And then because we reduced so many people, there was the opportunity, of course, to go in and do major consolidation and departmental reorganization and package the railroad tighter and more effectively with less management and overhead, and we've done that too. Slide 15, we're not gonna try to explain this, but it is the best slide I've ever seen that a person who wonders how the railroad gets its money and what it does with it, if you sit down and look at this slide and track it, it's all right here. And I'll just leave it at that. A staff member, for example, or even yourselves can get an idea of how the corporate net earnings come about, which part is federal, which part is match, and so on and so forth. Those numbers that are in there are as best we know them for 2009 year end, and they're all pretty accurate. What I'd like to do now, Mr. Chairman, is to do the Huntley-Brinkley, is turn it over to Bill, our CFO, and let him actually start talking a little bit more about the financials as they were and as they're coming about for 2009, and a peek under the tin of 2010.
I'm going to watch the clock to help you guys. We'll go take the presentation for maybe another 15 minutes. Will that be enough, you think?
We'll be done by that.
Yeah, and then we'll have 15 or minutes for questions. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Bill O'Leary. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Railroad, and we can move through this pretty rapidly here. Slide 16 in front of you is just a little history on our freight revenue, which, as you see in one of the earlier charts that we provided, is roughly half of the total revenue for the Alaska Railroad. And you see sort of a history from 2004 to 2008, and then the expectation that we had building the budget for 2009. And then, unfortunately, what the actual numbers look like. We had significant weakness in the petroleum haul, the petroleum we moved from the North Pole refinery, Flint Hills refinery. We also had much weaker results on our interline barge service, which is reflective primarily of the reduced activity or diminished activity on the North Slope. We support a lot of the activity up there with our rail barge. As we'll see in a little bit, or another slide here, one of the only bright spots on our freight side was that related to export coal, which was up. But that's all embodied in those particular freight numbers. Slide 17 is just a graphic on on petroleum and the amount of fuel that we have shipped or has been moved on the Alaska Railroad by MAPCO, Williams, and Flint Hills, predecessors to Flint Hills, from 1994 to 2009, and really to a large degree tells the story of the Alaska Railroad's finances. Very strong growth curve seen from 94 through 2003, annually growing at about 9% average. And unfortunately, in starting in especially the 2006 timeframe with Flint Hills' election to no longer produce naphtha, a much more rapid come down, 8% loss per year average from 2004 through our 2009 numbers, of a very significant concern to the railroads, to the railroad financially. Slide 18 is just a recent history on tonnages of export coal. Coal mined at the Use Belly mine in Healy moved on the Alaska Railroad to Seward, where then shipped to international destinations. And 2009 was a record year for us, moving a little over 800,000 metric tons of export coal. This is, you know, really we're anticipating even better results for 2010 for this particular line of business, but there is the specter of a lawsuit alleging violations of the Clean Water Act, which was filed right at the end of this, the end of last year, which could place this line of business in some level of jeopardy. Slide 19 is our revenue look on what's probably the most or best known line of business for the Alaska Railroad, our passenger service. And again, a very nice growth curve from 2004 through 2008, helped to a large degree by the railroad introducing first-class service to its passenger. We purchased a number of bi-level dome cars, which we took the final delivery of those in 2009. 2008, we were anticipating it improving our revenues. The numbers you see, that didn't come about given the recession. 2020, real estate revenue, our far and away our most consistent performer. Slide 21 is just a sort of graphical representation of what Mr. Gamble spoke of regarding our cost reduction efforts. And you see that we've taken about $8 million out over the last 2 years on our what we call controllable expenses, those things that can't cut depreciation without a whole lot of trouble. It's a lot more difficult to go in and cut benefits, things of that nature. And we also have a 2010 budget number in there to show the look at what we're moving there. So it all shakes down to slide 22. We're looking at 2009 unaudited net income of a little over $13 million. And you see how that compares with our history since transfer from the federal government in 1985.
Could you just pause there for a second on your net income? And I notice on your conglomerated slide that we just glanced over, you have operational cash flow. And can you just touch on on what you're expecting your cash flow from operations this year and is going to be, and maybe what you're expecting the impact could be next year?
At this particular point, you'll see a slide a little bit later on talking about 2010's budget. You know, we're going to show corporate net income of 13.6 for 09. Right now, we're budgeting a little bit over $8 million of net income for 2010. And, you know, we think we will, if that comes to pass, again, we're on a calendar year, so we're just starting our year at this point. But if that comes to pass, we'll have a loss of roughly $4 million on from operations.
Cash flow from operations.
Correct.
Which is not net income.
Correct.
I understand the terms.
Yeah, net income from operations.
Question.
Cash flow from operations. Net income from operations would be a $4 million loss. We would certainly have positive cash flow from operations, though.
Okay.
The way to think about that, Mr. Chairman, is that's basically the train operations. That's basically what we make off our trains.
Right.
A dollar in and a dollar out is a 1.0 operating ratio. The lower that number goes, the better it is. The expenses in the numerator. We're not breaking even on the train operations piece, but corporately, when you include everything that comes in and goes out, corporately, our health looks a lot different than that one component of the company.
Right, I understand that.
And that's principally made up, of course, of labor costs and fuel are the two biggies on the expense side.
And I think it's reflected in this chart.
At slide 23, just some balance sheet highlights out there. The railroad, basically takeaways on this are, you know, we have managed our balance sheet even with our diminished earnings. You know, our asset base has grown, our liquidity is good, we are a low debt entity, having about $27 million of recourse debt. We do have about $157 million remaining on the bonds we have issued backed by federal monies. And we did generate in 2009 about $31 million total cash that was then used for a number of our purposes.
I'll say a word quickly about 2010. As I said before, tough year. Flint Hills, the Export Coal lawsuit, we've already had to start accruals according to the rules, and that came right off the bottom line for 2009, as well as it's going to come off the bottom line for 2010 to some degree, I expect. We don't see anything good right now on the passenger side of the house. That's down considerably. We had had successive record years, and all of a sudden we've just taken a real dive there. So our challenge is to continue to figure out how to save ourselves on the expense side while we're out looking for new revenue and hopefully finding it, because that's really how we're going to recover, is we've got to find new revenue. We can't save ourselves to prosperity forever. There's just not that much more stuff to cut, and it gets smaller and smaller in terms of its impact. You see on the bottom of the chart then not only the operating net income projection, but what we're projecting for capital. And here's the interesting part about the Alaska Railroad. Because we have these components to our business, our capital program is much more robust than would be expected of a company of our size with the kind of net earnings that we make. And that's because of the federal entitlements, which we tap into, that runs everything from the formula funds that come because we move passengers, like every other passenger railroad in the U.S., as well as our share of something like stimulus. When something like stimulus comes along, we got a share of stimulus to pump back into the railroad. So our capital program remains relatively robust, although it's down as well. And a little bit more as we go to the capital side, you see on slide 25, the three we're on our second five-year plan. We actually operate off a strategic plan and five-year plans. And we're in our second five-year plan. 2008-12 is the second one. There are three big projects on the capital list. The Tanana Bridge, it's $100 million plus that we currently have toward that project, and we're designing it and working land issues. The line rebuild, Bill mentioned, we've got 100 miles left to go between Anchorage and Fairbanks. We'll do 40 miles this year, 40 miles next year, and then 20 miles the last year. And then that'll be done, and we will have rebuilt the line between Anchorage and Fairbanks. We've got to start looking south now down towards Seward. And then finally, collision avoidance. This is an unfunded congressional mandate. By 2016, we've got to have a on-track collision avoidance system that meets all the federal specifications, and we're looking at that costing us somewhere in the neighborhood of $75 million unfunded. We've probably put up close to half of that already, and we're trying to figure out where we're going to get the rest of it.
And just following on Pat's comments, on slide 26 is just a little breakout of the fund sources we have for our capital program and just the total spend that we did have for both 2008 and 2009. Biggest pieces of this, of course, are the FTA monies, which are formula monies that we receive, and then also we are still spending down the bond proceeds from our debt issuances in 2006 and 2007 related to that track rehabilitation program that Pat discussed. Slide 27 is just a discussion about a little more breakout on some of those fund sources. Really, the next two slides in your briefing are our five-year plan for capital. And not planning on walking through those, just making you aware that they're there, shows the different fund sources we anticipate and the projects that we have identified to this point.
These charts were in your report to the legislature that we, by law, bring up and send to all your offices every year. They're in that report as well.
Only other point, very briefly, I wanted to make, there's a number of slides here on the employee benefit package that we have, especially related to our defined benefit pension plan and post-retirement medical program. Not going to go through those. Going to jump to slide 39. very briefly. As is the case in many plans, they were doing very, very well up until the market crash of 2008. We have had a really appears to be a very good recovery in 2009 on our investments. We have not gone through the actuarial process to receive what our liabilities are. 2009, we'll be getting that in the next few days. But at this point, before the crash, we were 114% funded in our pension fund and about 75% funded in our medical fund. That fell markedly, but I think we'll be pushing closer towards fully funded status when all is said and done at the end of 2009.
Finally, to conclude, I just call slide 40 wild cards, and we could talk about any of those that you'd like to, but the possible strengths are also the possible weaknesses to a large degree. The new guys on the block are the increase in environmental concerns, and then in terms of the Corporate Act itself, there are items of legislation that are being proposed that would get into the Corporate Act itself, and we can talk about those as well, the Executive Budget Act. And then I think recently we got a House Bill 313, which talks about some expenses that the railroad might incur. And I list those just because they are up here and you might see them. Mr. Chairman, that completes our very fast top-line overview, and we'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. I just, for those watching and in the audience, I thought it'd be nice to have the railroad to come in, even though it's, we're coming off of a time that's not very robust. We didn't expect good information. I know there'll be several presenters this, session that dealing with the recessionary times that are impacting us, but to make the decisions here at the table, we need to know the soft spots and how soft particular spots are. So I appreciate you not putting a bunch of sugar and spice on it and just kind of telling us what you're dealing with so we can try to help you is what we're trying to do here. We have a lot of interest in the fuel component dealing with not only the Anchorage Airport, but our military and so on and so forth. So could you give us a 60-second blast on just the fuel component of what you carry historically the last few years and kind of where you feel you are today? And you mentioned earlier you thought it might be maybe flat going forward or maybe down a little bit, and kind of break it into sections, and then we'll go on to Senator Thomas.
The nature, Mr. Chairman, of our fuel business is, as I like to say very simply, we just haul stuff. So we've got a producer and we've got a customer, and there's a pull on that producer, and we're the intermediary. We're also the storage for that fuel. If you think about it, we are the pipeline, and everything that's in those tanks are more or less just in time heading for the airport. So they don't have huge tanks that they have to build, because coming from the refinery to the airport, we're the just-in-time movement of the fuel at whatever rate it needs it. There's a buffer in the tanks that they've got, But up to now, the model has been that the pipeline actually supplies the demand to the airport for the approximately 50% that Flint Hills in the past has provided to the airport to satisfy airport demand. We've seen that 50% now go down to the point where we're now projecting for 2010, based on their projections to us, which we get updated on a regular basis. We'll end up moving about half of what we moved at the maximum, say, 4 years ago. From a revenue and cash flow position, plus this is margin business, and not all revenue is equal, as the CEO likes to tell me all the time. When you've got high volume, high margin, and you replace it with high volume, low margin, it's not the same. So when you see coal go up and fuel go down, it's not the same to the bottom line. That's why we keep talking about fuel, and that's why our concern right now rests with either getting fuel back on its feet, however that can be done, or trying to offset it by finding other business that's out there someplace. And that's a more problematic prospect, because there aren't big businesses ready to just drop in and substitute for that kind of cash flow, unless we take on something like a pipeline or offshore drilling or something like that that would provide a long-term big business. And that's very much a possibility that we're looking forward to and preparing for. But as of right now, I've told the company, we've got to hunker down for 2 years just to find out what the next 5 years are going to look like, because we can't predict right now. My five-year plan is blown up. I can't look out more than two, and those two are defensive years where I'm just hunkering down the corporation and trying to cut costs just to keep the health of the corporation intact so that we can recover and rebound. And that's my strategy right now. You'll notice in the numbers, while operating losses are occurring, corporate health in terms of liquidity, in terms of cash flows, in terms of facilities, debt, all those things are really not in bad shape at all. Real estate is very robust right now. And so that's holding us together while we wait through these 2 years to see what the future is going to bring.
Okay, thank you. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a couple issues. One of my favorite, obviously, the Southern Bypass, and we seem to struggle with that moving forward, even to a EIS or any kind of plan to move that project forward. And I realize you have your desires to do a portion of that on the other end, which is all well and good. But we're obviously looking to move that project forward in some respects to get a little handle on it before it becomes even more difficult to acquire land, those types of things. So if you could comment on that just briefly, and also the idea of Flint Hills, if in fact they express to you, I understand they have a large expansion planned this spring and summer, if in fact they talk with you about what takes place after that expansion is done, which we would anticipate, at least hope, that would increase production and have a positive impact on your traffic.
Southern Bypass, you'd be happy to know that I went before the Assembly last week. We talked about the Southern Bypass. I've since discussed with a couple of the Assembly members about having a meeting, which we're going to have on the 12th, in which we're going to get our engineers to the table and for the first time scope the project and take the issue of costing as much off the table as we possibly can and actually pin down what we think the zone that we're talking about really is for a project of that magnitude. That will spit out, as a result, a good estimation of what an EIS, the first step, would cost. And then we can actually focus on something real instead of just debating the high-low aspects of estimates. We'll get the engineers to the table. And the meeting will be brokered by an individual who has construction knowledge of what the subject will be. So I think we're actually going to make a nice step forward on that one.
We have about 10 minutes, 8 minutes. Senator Ellis is preparing for the floor, but so we still have time to proceed with some questions.
Just a short couple of questions.
Follow up, and then we'll go to Senator Olson.
Not necessarily for answer now, but just for you to think about, and it's some other issues that we've talked about, one being the Healy subdivision and the potential for that being released by the railroad and allowed those folks to purchase the property that their homes, which they own, sets on, as well as you do relocations, that land that you are vacating and a process of returning that to the original owners of that property, which there will be a fair amount, obviously, in the Fairbanks area when realignment is concluded. So those are obviously important questions to my constituency.
And we recognize those, and they're very much at the heart of the issue.
Senator Olson, and then Senator Huggins, you have a question? Okay, then we'll go to Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As an operator of an aircraft, I guess one of the things that draws me to a screeching halt is when I can't get fuel. And it's been brought to my attention that Anchorage International Airport ran out of fuel in the recent past, where they weren't able to go ahead and take care of some of the carriers that were coming through. And as you dig down into it, one of the concerns that happened was that in order to cut costs, the railroad went ahead and decreased the amount of cars that were coming down. And that was one of the reasons there was a slow up in some of the airline operations out there and the fuel problem that came to the forefront. I just wanted you to comment on that and to see if that is indeed was the case, so we can avoid that in the future. Because as we found out, as we just heard during the last hour, the airport in Anchorage is a very vital part of transportation here in the state of Alaska, and airlines cannot run without fuel.
Senator Olson, I had not heard that comment. My answer has to be technical in two parts. Number one, yes, the number of cars was less coming down because the amount of fuel that they were refining had been reduced so much that we reduced the size of the train to haul just what they were putting in the cars. So in technically that's true, but it was the cart before the horse, if you will. When that happened at the airport, I called the CEO of Flint Hills and I said, what the heck is going on? You guys have always, given the fuel. This doesn't sound right. Are we missing something? His comment to me, and I won't go any farther than this because it really is for somebody else to talk about this, but his comment to me on our personal phone call, and he wouldn't mind me saying this, is we signed a contract for a certain amount of fuel, and we are delivering every gallon of that fuel that we signed the contract for, no more, no less. If they want more fuel from us, somebody has to come and negotiate the additional fuel. And then it gets into where Christine was talking about, looking for other sources to offset. Because what they wanted to do was shut down that third tower in the refinery. By shutting that down, they cut a number of their costs. And their view is that when the demand at the airport goes up high enough for the long term, they will be more than happy to rebid a contract for more fuel and turn on that tower again, which only refines fuel. It doesn't refine any other products. That's the story as far as I know it to be right now, Senator.
Chairman, a follow-up question?
Yeah, quick follow-up, and then we'll go to Senator Huggins and then Hoffman.
I just want to comment that information that came to my office was not by any governmental official, so that it was actually from the private sector. But the other concern that I have is actually from a former constituent of mine. It has to do with some of the claims that are against the railroad, and I was wondering what the status of that was related to one employees that have either gotten hurt or have claims against the railroad, but more importantly against some of the real estate issues that are out there where you got land usage and some of the claims that are there that are have been going on for a long period of time.
Senator, the issue of land usage is probably one of the lightning rod issues that we deal with on a regular basis. And the fundamental issue, and one really that I think it falls directly in the laps of legislators in Juneau, is we're the stewards of the state's land, 36,000 acres. Up to now in the Corporate Act specifically says we can't sell that land. And if we do anything with it other than a few things, we've got to come back here and get approval to do it. So the idea of selling the property off to constituents, which is out there, and you can understand why. They build a building, they got a 55-year lease, they want to own their property after years of paying rent.
Mr. Chairman.
What they want to do is buy the property, and I can't sell it, so the law has to be changed.
Mr. Chairman, my question was more toward private land owners that have railroads going across their property.
Oh, I misunderstood you, Senator.
Yeah, we'll try to accelerate. We got just a few minutes left, and I want to get to the other two senators here. Sorry for.
Shall I address that one?
Yeah, just real briefly, and then you can get with Senator Olson for a more detailed answer afterwards.
When we move the railroad tracks, and North Pole is a good example, if we move the railroad tracks out of North Pole and go down along the levee, our full intention is to give up that property, and what'll happen is it goes back to the state. We're dealing with the Attorney General because the state has no way to take that property and then dispense it to the adjacent landowners. You have to have a legal vehicle. We're working with the Attorney General's department to write language so that the state can take that land back and return it to the adjacent landowners when we leave it.
Okay, Senator
thank
Huggins.
You, thank
you. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question has to do, Mr. Gamble, with the railroad is a weather vane, an economic weather vane. And I've come to the conclusion after listening to the business community and listening to your presentation that the railroad well may be a good weather vane for us to pay attention to, and it's a red flag, kind of like a red storm warning. I see from 2007 to 2009 you laid off or you reduced your personnel staffing by 200 people. 41% of those were managers and on. And then you described to us your commodity movement, how it's been decreasing, and then there's some suits out there that further impacts that, and Flint Hills may close and all those sorts of things, which says, and then you mentioned the tourist industry, potentially passengers, if you will, that's down. And if you're in fact a good weather vane, should we be concerned, or are you a good weather vane potentially for the economy moving forward for the state of Alaska?
Senator, I think we are a very good weather vane because most of our business is internal Alaska business. It's stuff coming in and stuff interior Alaska supporting the slope, goods going to Fairbanks that come in on the barge. The airport, of course, is a big one, and that's very near real time. I mean, those numbers go up and down very, very quickly. So I think you're absolutely right. I think we are. And the other side of that coin is, and there's not much we can do about it until that economic engine cranks back up and starts moving goods and services. And when those goods and service move, we move a lot of them. So, yes, we are a weather vane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And the final question, Senator Hoffman.
Yes, you could get back with me on this, but I would like to see what the history is. You said that Flint Hills provides 50% of the fuel to the airport. And I don't know when, if that's today or with the decreased amount and they were providing more in the future. I would like a history of the gallons that were being provided. But the it seems to me, in listening to the presentation on Alaska International Airport and your presentation, there seems to be a fuel storage problem at the airport and maybe someplace at, in South Central that needs to be addressed. But the other information that I'd like from you is your capacity, what you've been purchasing the fuel for and how much you've been using over the last 5 years. And you can get that to my office when you can. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And thank you for coming forward today to do your presentation, and hopefully next year that'll be a little bit more upbeat and maybe it'll be really smiley in 2 years, we all hope, but we're here to try to help the situation. So,
Senator, last year the slides, there were 75, we're down to 40, maybe next year we'll be down to 20.
Yeah, that sounds like a good number. We'll see everybody Friday 9 a.m. meeting adjourned.